Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. This hour on the program, what did you have for breakfast this morning? Was it real food, or was it something processed from a box or even a can? Now, was it nutritionally adequate? Do you know that it was because the slogan on the box told you it was nutritionally adequate? Well, my guest this hour, journalist and educator Michael Pollan, says he wants to speak out in defense of real food. He says food and eating need to be defended against the shifting winds of nutrition science and food industry marketing. Michael Pollan notes that we're the only animal that needs professional help in choosing what to eat. And in spite of all this assistance, we have an American paradox. We are a notably unhealthy population, preoccupied with nutrition and diet and the idea of eating healthily. We're going to find out more, including suggestions for what to eat and how to eat. Michael Pollan, professor of journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, author of, I'm sure you know the books, The Botany of Desire and The Omnivore's Dilemma. And Michael Pollan's new book is called In Defense of Food. It's subtitled An Eater's Manifesto from the Berkeley area. Welcome, Michael Pollan. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Good to be back.
And we're at 614-292-8513. Michael, we ought to be able to, in a sense, just to sit down and eat, but it's so complicated, and every day's press gives us new information about this nutrient or that nutrient and why we ought to eat this or why we ought to eat that. And we don't really need the professional help, you're saying.
No, I mean, I think we've been, confused and baffled for a long time by, as you say, conflicting science, conflicting journalism, and conflicting claims from the food manufacturers themselves. Food is being sold on the basis of health claims increasingly, and they're very hard to sort out, not just because they're contradictory, but some are based on very sketchy science. So what I was trying to do with this book is kind of answer the question for myself as to how could you eat, how could you possibly cut through all that confusion. And what I discovered is that, you know, you really don't need to fill your head with all that science and biochemistry. And, you know, it's that this, you know, people knew how to eat for thousands of years before they knew what an antioxidant is. And you don't need to know what one is either. If you eat real food, if you eat the kind of food that was around 7,500 years ago and has been, you know, least fiddled with. So it's a very back to basics kind of message. Mm-hmm. But it's based on having passed through a deep acquaintance with all the science and the nutritional wars of the last few years.
Michael, you say that culturally, in families, we used to pass down information about food, and we took it from our parents. I guess some of that information was good, and maybe not so good, some of it, huh?
Well, on balance, it was good. I mean, I'm amazed at how often the supposed old wives' tales and sayings of our ancestors about food turn out now to have scientific validation. I was on a talk radio program in Australia, of all places, the other day, and someone called up and said, well, her grandmother used to always say you should eat your colors, eat as many different colored fruits and vegetables as possible. Now, she had no understanding why that should be, but we've since learned that each of those colors reflects the presence of a different phytochemical antioxidant of some kind, and indeed you need a variety of those antioxidants, and one way to assure you're getting them is to eat different colored foods. So sometimes the scientists come late to wisdom that the culture developed on its own through a very, you know, long-term process of trial and error. And my hunch in this book is that culture still has a lot to teach us about food, perhaps more than science does. And, you know, when it comes to food, culture is really just a fancy word for your mom or your great-grandmother because, you know, many of the moms have, unfortunately, had the confidence in their food traditions undermined by industry and science and journalists.
So, yeah, my mom says, eat your vegetables, right? And
yeah.
That's right.
She's right. And my mom, you know, my mom fed us stick margarine all through the 60s. And because that was the public health message, you know, that animal fats were evil and you should get your fat from polyunsaturated, you know, fatty acids from vegetables. And the whole time she was saying, you know, someday they're going to figure out that butter is better for you than margarine.
Yeah.
Well, so she knew that butter was better for you than margarine. The scientists didn't know, and they've since figured it out. And they've learned that, in fact, that stick margarine I was getting is full of lethal trans fats that are much worse than saturated fats. So, you see, had she trusted her instincts, I would have been better off, and my heart would have been better off. But she didn't. She was trusting a public health campaign that turned out to be based on some erroneous assumptions.
There's always the nutritional element or the nutritional advice of the month. You know, 1 month it's the low-fat diet. The next month it's vitamin D. The next month it is antioxidants. And as you point out, in defense of food, you know, some of this advice has turned out to be, in fact, precisely wrong.
Yeah, well, you know, people have been, the reason we have so much advice, we should go back to the beginning, is because we know that there's something wrong with the diet and that the way people are eating in the Western world today leads to a set of chronic diseases with some predictability, everything from obesity and type 2 diabetes to cardiovascular disease and many kinds of cancer. What we don't know is precisely what in that Western diet is responsible. And so that's what people fight about. Is it micronutrient deficiencies? Is it too much fat? Is it the wrong kind of fat? Is it too much refined carbohydrate? And those are the debates. That's what the nutritional wars are about. But they're all about figuring out what in this Western diet, which, let me define it for you briefly, is a diet characterized by, first, lots of calories, second, lots of refined grains and carbohydrates, such as sugars and white flour, refined oils also, vegetable oils very often, lots of meat, and very little fruits, vegetables, and whole grains. That's, by the way, how most of us eat. That's the fast food or the supermarket diet, by and large, and the processed food diet. But if you keep your eye on the ball, which is to say that there's something in that diet that makes people sick pretty reliably, then you realize the project is not to figure out that magic bullet, good or bad, but the project is to get off that diet. And so how do you do that? Because we don't have to wait for the scientists to sort that all out. We can decide right now to not eat that way or to eat that way as little as possible, and we will kind of circumvent all those arguments.
So, Michael, you point out that there's a lot of evidence that shows when people move from a diet that is not the Western diet in some other part of the world, you know, and I think the Aborigines in Australia were one example.
And immigrants in this country, too.
Yeah.
Mexican-Americans, I mean, are very reliable. There's an article in the paper today about the obesity epidemic, and they were pointing out that new arrivals to this country suffer much higher rates of type 2 diabetes. Why is that? Well, they're less, their bodies are, you know, are, get the shock of these waves of sugar and glucose in our diet and can't cope with it, as well as people who've been exposed to it for a long time. And that's how we understand the Western diet. We watch its effect on populations that are newly exposed to it. And that's how we first learned about it about 100 years ago. We had this generation of British medical workers all over the colonies, people like Albert Schweitzer and others you haven't heard of. And they were in these communities where they watched Western food, what they called store food, show up for the first time. And they were operating clinics, and they would see suddenly various cancers, heart disease, diabetes, things that had never existed in these communities before, suddenly show up. And they made the correlation. Mm-hmm. We've also found, though, interestingly, that when you take those populations out of the Western context and put them back on their traditional diets, miraculously, the effects of that diet are rolled back, by and large. You have this... blood pressure goes down, evidence of heart disease goes down, insulin levels regularize, normalize. That's very heartening, too, because that means you can roll back the effects of this diet.
Seems that almost everybody I know is on some kind of cholesterol medication or that and high blood pressure medication, plus an antidepressant, usually all three. I mean, that's it.
That is what we're doing. Yeah, we're medicating our way out of these problems.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that's really a shame. I mean, you know, as I see it, we're at a fork in the road, you know, and one fork leads to, you know, the Lipitor Nation and a dialysis center on every street corner in the inner city to deal with all the kidney problems from diabetes, and bariatric surgery and, you know, all, and new fat pills and fad diets. You know, that's one path, and that's the path we're on. And the other path is we change our diet. It's so much simpler. But, of course, that simpler path will reward industry much less. There's money to be made with medical and technological interventions to deal with these problems. There's not money to be made returning to a traditional diet because when you do, you're cutting out the corporations that are cooking our meals, basically, and you're cooking them again yourself, and you're shopping at the farmer's market, and you're buying simple foods that are not that profitable to sell.
Michael Pollan, professor of journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, his new book, In Defense of Food. We're at 614-292-8513. By the way, Michael, I've got to say that the culture doesn't make it very easy to get away from our Western diet. For example, the other day I went out to a local supermarket, I didn't want to go to a fast food place for lunch, so I went to the supermarket and I thought, well, among other things, I'm going to get me maybe an apple or a banana or something like that. And you look and the bananas are all green, so you can't.
Right.
Yeah, and the apples are pretty tasteless, and so you think, yuck, it doesn't make it any easier.
It doesn't. And, look, you go to the gas station and what kind of food is available there? It's all processed food. Everything is designed for a long shelf life. And to push your buttons, frankly, with lots of salt, sugar, and fat. I mean, we respond to these things, and the processors know it. It's hard to find that healthy snack, and it takes a little bit more work. And I know, I'm packing my son's lunch bag, and, all the healthy foods are going to get crushed. And the stuff in the boxes and the bags and the, all the stuff that's been designed for convenience is the stuff he wants to carry in his lunch bag,
sure.
But that's precisely what he shouldn't be getting.
So what do you generally pack in his
bag? Well, he ends up with, little cups of applesauce that get crushed. And apples. Apples will hold up pretty well. And, I find containers, sturdy containers to put strawberries and grapes in and things like that. And he has a pretty simple lunch at school. I always give him a bag of nuts, of almonds or something like that to hold him over. Because there's a healthy, convenient snack.
Does his school serve a healthy meal?
Well, actually, they do, and he just doesn't happen to like it.
Okay.
He's one of the pickiest eaters going. Occasionally, they'll have soup, and he'll have that, but he also doesn't like waiting in line for it. So he'd rather play Frisbee at lunchtime, so he needs something really fast.
Michael, what you point out also is that, really, humans can exist on some pretty extreme diets. I mean, the Inuit people, before all this food got up there, all this processed food got up.
Yeah, seal blubber and lichens.
Yeah, I mean, and they were very healthy.
It's really one of the striking facts that there is no ideal human diet. I mean, that's the thing we should realize when everybody's coming along telling us, eat this way or eat that way. If you look around the world historically, you will find an incredible range of traditional diets, ranging from the Inuit, the Maasai, who basically eat cattle blood and milk and some meat, Central American Indians, who do very well on corn and soybeans. Corn and beans. You go around the world, and you will find that people have developed really healthy diets out of what nature had to offer them in those places. The weird thing is, though, that we have managed to invent the one diet out there that pretty reliably makes us sick. What an achievement for a civilization, huh?
Well, is it also something about how we eat? Because among your suggestions, say, always eat at a table, for example. Try not to eat alone. What about that?
Well, one of the things we overlook is we focus so much on the food that we're taking in or not taking in that we overlook the fact that the way we eat, the habits that surround our eating, are just as important to our health. So that if you're snacking 24/7, whatever you eat, you're going to eat too much of it. And because we eat mindlessly when we snack and when we eat alone. So the mere act of eating at meals, at tables with other human beings, moderates appetite, slows us down. When we eat more slowly, we eat less. It takes the stomach 20 minutes or so to inform the brain that it's had enough. So if you can eat slowly, you will suddenly find your appetite decline. You don't need as much. And then there are, various cultural rules about gluttony that you're supposed to chew your food and you're supposed to, eat in a moderate way. All these little things are very important. We read a lot about the French paradox, these people who eat all this foie gras and other kinds of saturated fat and lots of red wine and they're healthier than we are. How could that possibly be? Well, I think we have to look at the French portion size, which is a lot smaller than ours, and the fact they have taboos on snacking. They think it's gross to eat in your car, yet Americans eat about 20% of our food in the car.
Also, they eat more slowly. I think if you get a table in Paris for an evening,
That's right. That's right. And people eat much more slowly. It's a social event. They seldom eat alone. Eating communally is a really big deal. And all these things, the food culture that surrounds eating has a tremendous bearing. And in our country, whatever food culture we had, and I have to say that you go back 100 years and it's not like Americans were eating so well. I mean, we've been known for speedy eating for hundreds of years. We were very perfunctory about meals, and we would eat quickly without talking and just gobble our food and run. So, you know, we have a lot to learn from cultures that have figured out how to make a real ritual of meals. And we have to, you know, we have to learn what we can from them.
So over your research for Indefensive Food and before that, The Omnivore's Dilemma and The Botany of Desire and all this, how has your diet changed? What did you do?
Well, in the course of learning about where my food came from, which is really the kind of journey I've been on for the last couple of years, beginning with Botany of Desire and Omnivore's Dilemma, I have seen things that have kind of shocked me.
Yeah.
I mean, I've spent time on feedlots and in slaughterhouses, and I know where the beef comes from now. And so I can't really enjoy industrial, you know, feedlot beef. I mean, I still eat meat, but I eat, you know, grass-fed meat from smaller ranchers whose animals live outdoors and get the diet they're evolved to eat. And the result is a very healthy product. It's a little harder to find. I avoid, you know, industrial meat in general. I eat a whole lot more vegetables than I did. We'll often have a dinner where we have a tiny piece of meat, like 4 ounces or 3 ounces, and four different vegetables, not just a starch and one vegetable. And I've really come to like them a lot and learned how to cook them, you know, so that they're as, you know, tasty as they can be. What else? We get out of the supermarket as much as we can. I try to shop in alternative outlets such as the farmer's market,
sure,
which here in California is pretty easy to do. It's open 50 weeks a year. I know it excites envy in Ohio.
It does.
But so we are lucky that way. And I joined a CSA, too, which
Community Supported Agriculture, yeah?
Yeah, which is a kind of a, it's like you subscribe to a farm and you get a weekly box of produce during the growing season. And again, here it's most of the year. And that's a very interesting way to eat because you never know what you're going to get. And it gets you out of your rut. And suddenly you find yourself, you know, figuring out what to do with a rutabaga that you might not have known what to do with. And that's actually kind of interesting because most of us just buy the same old stuff every week in the supermarket, and this does get you out of your rut. And they often provide recipes telling you how to cook it. What else? I cook a lot more, and I think that's a really important part of the whole picture. It is our reluctance or lack of time to cook that makes us vulnerable to the seductions of processed food, and that is really where you get into trouble because when corporations cook for you, they don't do a very good job, basically.
Yeah.
They cook with too much salt, too much sugar, too much fat. And when you take back control over your meals, you will just without even thinking be eating more healthily. You won't be eating preservatives that, you know, have been correlated with attention deficit disorder, and you won't be eating these very high levels of salt, fat, and sugar.
Yeah. Are you able to now? There's a diet called the DASH diet. DASH is an acronym for Dietary Approach to Stop Hypertension.
Yeah.
And among the non-fat dairy products, very little meat, and 8 to 10 servings of fruits and vegetables a day. Are you able to get up to that 8 to 10?
I don't know if I get up to 8 to 10. I've never figured out what a serving of fruit or vegetables really is. It's actually not that much.
Right.
I might get up there if you threw in whole grain, which we eat a fair amount of here. I mean, the DASH diet is a specific therapeutic diet for people with high blood pressure. And you know, the low-fat, it's very much part of that low-fat mantra. I mean, it's probably a healthy diet, but we're learning that if the right kinds of fats are not so bad for you, and that we've demonized saturated fat perhaps too much, and that the fats from refined vegetable oil, especially if they're, you know, hydrogenated or partially hydrogenated, are so much worse. And take a look at how much hydrogenated soy oil is in your diet. The average American are getting 10% of their calories from that one ingredient. And that's a really troublesome ingredient. So, you know, you might be better off eating a little bit of meat or full-fat dairy than all that hydrogenated soy. In general, with regard to dairy, I'd rather eat less full-fat than lots of low-fat. For many people, the word low-fat becomes a license to eat too much.
Yes.
Just because something is low in fat doesn't mean it's not fattening. You know, we had the Snackwells craze a few years ago where you know, this line of, you know, forgive me, junk food was sold on the basis right. Of the fact that it had no fat at all. But to compensate for the lack of flavor from no fat, they really amp up the sugar. And, you know, sugar gets you fat, too. You know, we have this weird correlation between the word fat as a nutrient and the fat on our bodies. But refined carbohydrates are, you know, just as reliably the body can turn into fat.
Michael, let me ask you, in defense of food, you quote T. Colin Campbell from Cornell University, right?
Yeah.
He did this study. He's been on our program, and he did this study of villages in China. And he concluded that the more animal proteins they put into their diet over time, the greater the rates of cancer. So his idea, he said he and his whole family had become vegans and they weren't eating any meat at all. What do you think of that?
I think it's extreme. You know, people have been eating meat for thousands of years. It's hard for me to believe that in and of itself it is toxic. Too much meat might be. Too much red meat, we do know, correlates with higher cancer rates. But meat is nutritious food. We are adapted to eat it. So I'm not against eating meat. I think there are reasons to eat a lot less of it than we do, environmental as well as health. I don't think the world can sustain meat eating on the order of 260 pounds per person per year, which is what the average American is getting. You know, just the climate change impact alone of that meat eating is disastrous.
Mm-hmm.
But to absolutely take animal protein out of the diet, you know, I haven't seen the, you know, I'm familiar with his work, but when you're lowering your meat intake, and let's say that does have a good health effect,
okay.
Is that the result of the absence of the protein in the meat, or the absence of the fat in the meat, or the absence of the hormones in the meat? Or could it be the presence of extra vegetables that's having the positive health effect? In other words, it's very hard in diet to isolate a single nutrient, present or absent, and say that that is the cause of the problem or the solution. So in general, the problem with meat eating may be that it pushes vegetables out of the diet.
Yeah.
Or maybe it is the protein in the meat. I'm not sure that that's established.
Yeah. In fact, one medical scholar on our program was aware of Colin Campbell's work, and he said he felt that Colin Campbell had misinterpreted his own data. That is to say, he didn't think it was the introduction.
Well, I've heard that. I've heard that argument, too. And the data is very interesting, and the correlation is very interesting. But going from a correlation to cause and effect is a huge step and takes a different kind of research, that's not epidemiological. And, you know, we have watched the Chinese diet as it's changed, these heart diseases come in. But that's that old story of the Western diet. In addition to adding meat to their diet, they've also added sugar. So maybe the problem is refined carbohydrates, like sugar, leading to inflammation, leading to cancers and heart disease. I mean, there's a theory of, you know, school of thought that believes that that's really the problem. So there you are again, lost in the nutrition wars. You know, they're really interesting, and I look forward to the day the scientists can nail this down. But in the meantime, let's not take our eye on, you know, off the ball and realize that this Western diet is the problem and, you know, reduce the meat in our diet and reduce the sugar.
Mm-hmm. We don't have to wait for the scientists to come up with something.
That's right.
You're suggesting culture has provided us with
strategies. With pretty good guidelines.
Pretty good guidelines,
go
yeah.
back and eat the way your great-grandmother did.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't like the way your great-grandmother ate, because I often hear this from, like, people in England, then yeah. eat the way a Sicilian great-grandmother would eat, and
yeah.
you'll be fine, or a Japanese great-grandmother. Either way, you know, traditional foods are really the best solution.
Yeah, speaking, coming from British stock and partly a British great-grandmother would be roasts, very little vegetables, overcooked.
Overcooked, yeah.
yeah
I know. I've had
the
people, when I say this in England, people go, oh, do I have to eat like my great-grandmother? And I say, no, pick another great-grandmother.
Michael Pollan joins us, educator and journalist. His new book, In Defense of Food, subtitled An Eater's Manifesto. We're going to take a pause for a couple of announcements here. Then back with my guest and callers. I'm going to invite you to call in at 614-292-8513 to talk about your diet and any changes you might have made and your observations about Michael Pollan's work. And also you can email your comments or questions to openline@wosu.org. Right back after these messages at WOSU 820. NPR News.
I'm Alex Chadwick.
Everything I said was honest. I go in the gray area a lot.
Dr. Dyer.
People really are fascinating, aren't they? But what is it that makes them do the things that they do?
We netted $750,000 a week.
Who, what, where, when, but also why?
I don't outwardly steal, but I go gray.
On NPR's Day to Day.
Day to Day begins in just about 30 minutes at noon, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Good morning, I'm Amy Jurevich. It is 56 degrees at 11:31. Thanks for joining us for Open Line this morning. Join us this weekend on WOSU-TV for two very special concert events, The High Kings Saturday night at 8 p.m. and Celtic Thunder Live in the WOSU studios Sunday night at 7 p.m. And by supporting WOSU-TV, you'll get the opportunity to see these artists live in concert. Watch WOSU-TV for details. Don't forget, you can now get all of the day's news from All Things Considered and business news from Marketplace. Now on WOSU 89.7 FM. Weekdays from 4 until 7 o'clock. And in the weather forecast for today, sunny skies and a high near 68. Clear tonight with a low of 42. And now, back to Open Line.
Welcome back to Open Line at WOSU 820 NPR News. I'm Fred Anderle. Joining us this hour, Michael Pollan, professor of journalism at the University of California, Berkeley, author of, you know, his books, The Botany of Desire and The Omnivore's Dilemma, his new book, In Defense of Food, subtitled An Eater's Manifesto. He says that the Western diet is just an absolute disaster in terms of being associated with long-term chronic diseases, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, various kinds of cancers. He says we know this diet doesn't work to prevent disease and protect us from it. He says there's a way to get out of it, and we're finding out how to do that now by farmers markets, by cooking ourselves, and we're going to talk about maybe growing some of our own food. But let's go to you, callers, at 614-292-8513. And again, open line at WOSU.org if you have a comment or question by email. And David is first on the line. Hello, David.
Hi. I think in addition to going back to our grandmothers' diets, we ought to go back to their lifestyles in terms of activity. You know, they got out and walked a lot. They had physical chores, hung the wash outside instead of popping it into a dryer, and rode bicycles instead of taking the cars. And,
yeah.
And of course, grandfathers, you know, plowing and working the fields and all that. And so I think that's actually a pretty interesting part of it. I notice when people like Lance Armstrong and these athletes do these very difficult Tour de France kind of things, they lose weight continuously no matter how much they eat because their activity level is so high.
Mm-hmm. Michael, what do you think about that?
Well, I think that's right. I think it's a part of the puzzle we don't talk about nearly enough, but that you cannot abstract a diet from a lifestyle. And the fact is we're very, very sedentary. And people who, you know, get lots of physical activity can eat very differently than we. I mean, if you go to the sugarcane plantations in Cuba, you know, we talk about the dangers of sugar. Well, they eat about 6,000 calories a day of sugar. They're just chewing on sugarcane the whole time. But, of course, they burn it all off, so they don't have problems with type 2 diabetes. So, yeah, I think we do have to pay attention to how our great-grandmothers lived as well and make sure we move our bodies as much. One of the things our great-grandmothers did, you know, probably was tend a garden. And tending a garden not only produces lots of very healthy, nutritious, you know, the most local food you can get, but it also requires some physical work. You actually have to enlist your body in its own support. And so I think that's a good way to kind of square the circle and make sure that you're getting some exercise at the same time you're eating well.
Yeah, and also, David and Michael, I have to say, our culture does not make this exercise easy. Now, after work today, I'm going to go over and get on a treadmill at a health club, an $8,000 machine, in order to get my heart rate up, you know? And you know, it's not built into our daily
work. No, it's really crazy. And, you know, we use all this, you know, fossil fuel energy to have these labor-saving, you know, machines and allow us to, you know, work at desks and not do physical work anymore. And then we have to burn more fossil fuel to go to the gym.
Yeah.
And take care of our bodies. It's nuts. I mean, we need to, we just have to make exercise a very routine part of our jobs. And that comes from redesigning our community so we can walk to work and we can walk to stores and, mm-hmm. you know, the American landscape has been designed to keep us in our cars or at our desk. And
surely.
I think that that's a tremendous part of the problem.
Yeah. David, thanks for the tip. That's important.
You're welcome.
Thanks for calling. Yeah, I know in Columbus, Michael, we don't have sidewalks on a lot of streets. So if I were to walk to work, there'd be a substantial portion of the journey where I would not have a sidewalk to walk on. So we're just
you would think that the auto companies had designed the whole physical environment in America. It's much more friendly to cars than human pedestrians.
Surely. Next caller, Gitahan. Am I pronouncing your name correctly? Hi, you're on the air.
Yeah, how you doing?
Good.
All right, this is Gita Honambo. Where I come from is Ethiopia, and my grandfather is eating a lot of fresh meat and a colangera. And that thing is not going to make me skinny at all, really make me a bigger stomach. So that's the style. So what is he suggesting about that?
Caller, are you from Ethiopia? That's right. And have you gained weight since you came here?
Yeah, I got a big stomach.
Oh man.
Well, you know, I mean, that's a classic situation when you get introduced to this the temptations of processed food. But also, our meat is probably very different than the meat that you ate in Ethiopia. We raise our animals very differently. We feed them lots of grain, which makes them very fat, and their meat has a lot more fat in it. Not to mention, you know, hormones and things like that. So that, you know, what might have been a traditional diet, say lots of meat in another country where the animals were perhaps raised on grass or had a healthier diet themselves is different. So, you know, all steaks are not created equal. And and that's one argument for finding, you know, grass-fed meat, for example. You know, if you are going to eat a lot of meat, that you can find meat that's more lean. It's the difference between eating wild game and feedlot meat. It's a very different product, even though it could be the same animal.
Caller, what do you think?
That's good, but really I like raw meat, you know, fresh meat. I don't know how I'm going to stop that. That might be the reason, and the injuries call.
Well, I think I would encourage you to go to the farmer's market and see if there are farmers who are growing. I mean, and I know there's some very good grass-fed meat being produced in Ohio, and if you can find that kind of meat, I think you'll find it has a lot less fat and is more like what you're accustomed to.
Sure, there are farmers markets in Bexley and Clintonville downtown, I think, as well in Worthington. So, caller, yeah, also, if you go to some of the natural food stores, you'll find that they've got organically raised meat grown right here in Ohio.
All right. Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks for your call. Next one here is Rob. Hello, Rob. You're on the air.
Hi, Mr. Pullen. I've enjoyed all your books, and I know from my reading you've spent quite a lot of time wandering the aisles of Whole Foods.
Yeah, yes, I have.
And I was just kind of curious as to your thoughts on some of the products, many of them organic, that are now being marketed for children, such as, organic fish sticks or chicken nuggets or just any number of items that are found in stores like that now for children. I know automatically a lot of people think organic is, well, it's got to be good for you, but what do you think of the way those items are produced in general?
You know, look, organic processed food from a health point of view is really no different than conventional processed food. I mean, if you're going to eat chicken nuggets, you shouldn't allow yourself to believe that because they have the word organic on them, they're suddenly a health food. I mean, I think you're right. We associate this word organic with health, but you can make some pretty unhealthy food with organic ingredients. I buy a lot of organic food, but we now have this kind of parallel food supply, which is taking every processed food and creating its organic double. We have organic candy. We have organic junk food. And, we shouldn't kid ourselves. That's still junk food. And it has all the problems. I mean, well, not all the problems, but most of the problems. You know, it still has lots of salt and fat. Perhaps it doesn't have the same kinds of preservatives. The animals had a better life in all likelihood, but it's different in its environmental impact, not really in its health impact. So I think it's a real shame that organic has gone down that path, because the word does have that association for people, but it's very misleading.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thank you.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks. Yeah, there are a lot of luxury foods that you could find at some of these Whole Foods and other kinds of supermarkets that really are, as you pointed out, highly processed and really luxury items. And I guess, Michael, also what bothers me, of course, is that, you know, there's a big premium markup on organic food. And I wonder, does your research show that it's actually better for you to eat an organic fruit and vegetable?
Well, there is now some reason. You're right about the premium, and it's very high right now because the demand for organic food is so high. But there is now some research, it's still kind of preliminary, that suggests that there are higher nutritional levels in organic produce if you grow it side by side with, you know, the same varieties of conventional produce. So you're getting more, beneficial nutrients when you eat organic. And as a result, I mean, many of those nutrients also are what impart flavor. It often is tastier. I think it is a superior product by many measures. Whether that justifies the premium is something you have to judge on your own. You know, whether you're getting 40% more vitamin C in an organic apple justifies the fact it costs 100% more than a conventional apple.
Sure.
Maybe you should eat two conventional apples, but you also have the benefit of less pesticide residues, and that's a positive. And the fact that you've supported an alternative kind of agriculture that, you know, is friendlier to the land and the wildlife and to the farm workers. So there are many, many reasons to buy it if you can afford it. But making a real narrow calculation, is this worth it? It really depends on your values and your pocketbook.
Yeah, I was going to say.
It's really expensive. I look forward to a day where the premium won't be so steep, but it will always be more expensive because the fact is it's grown with more care and more labor. And the reason cheap food is cheap is because corners are being cut, and the price of cheap food is not always reflected in the price at the register. A lot of the cost of that food, if you're talking about a piece of feedlot meat or a chemically sprayed apple, the real cost is being charged to the environment and the public health, and you don't see it, but it's there. No mistake, it's there. Cheap food is an illusion. You get with what you pay for in food, like everything else.
Agreed. You know, your key phrase, though, if you can afford the organic food, and what is of concern to me is that as a culture, we haven't made sufficient organic food available that people, you know, let's say if I'm in the central city and I can't get out to a Whole Foods market, and anyway, I've got an $8 an hour job and I can't afford it, you know, I'm stuck. And one of the nice things happening here in Columbus, and I'll bet it's happening there in Berkeley and Oakland, is the encouragement of people to grow their own food in their own neighborhoods, you know, on plots of land that
that's
are owned
right
by the city. Yeah.
And if you're, if you are on a budget and you want, that's the easiest way. Well, it's not the easiest way, but it's the most economical way to eat really high quality, fresh, organic produce is grow it yourself. You'll know exactly what you're getting. It will never be fresher. We forget about what an important contribution growing a little bit of your own food can make, and it doesn't take a lot of space. This country has, tens of thousands of square miles of front lawns, land on which the sun is shining every day, where we could be growing, a significant percentage of our food. During World War II, during the Victory Gardens, when everyone was encouraged to plant Victory Gardens to help with the war effort, this country was growing 40% of its produce, in home gardens. So it's not trivial, and that is one answer to the economic problem of organic. But it will come down. I mean, you talk about shopping at Whole Foods. They have very high margins, profit margins. When organic food is more common and more plentiful, those margins will come down, and there'll be more competition to sell it, and it will become more accessible. So I look forward to that day, too.
You know, Michael, here's a question that may not have an answer. I always am concerned about city gardens, in the backyards or front yards in terms of the pollution in the air, in terms of cars that pass by. Now, we don't have lead, thank God, coming out of the tailpipes anymore, but there are other pollutants as well, and I wonder if the plants absorb them and concentrate them.
That's a good question. I don't really know the answer. There's also a concern with urban soils sometimes, have lead in them from the past. And if you are planning a garden in the city, a vegetable garden, I would get the soil tested. There's always the option of moving to raised beds and bringing in soil that isn't contaminated. But many urban soils are contaminated, so you really should pay attention. If there are heavy leads, heavy metals in the soil, it can end up in the plant.
Surely. Michael Pollan, professor of journalism at the University of California, Berkeley. My guest, new book, In Defense of Food, An Eater's Manifesto. If you'd like to join us, 614-292-8513. Have you altered your diet? Would you like to do it? Emails to openline at WOSU.org. In this regard, Michael, you talked a little bit about soil depletion. Years ago, I went to a natural health clinic, and the very elderly woman, they're a very nice woman, said, you know, our soils are depleted. They don't have the nutrients in them, so the fruits and vegetables don't. And at the time, I sort of thought, well, I'm not so sure that's true, but I guess it turns out to be true.
It apparently is true. I mean, we have one of the more striking things I discovered in researching this book is that the nutritional quality of all our produce has declined over the last 50 years since we've been using chemical fertilizers. And with the result that if you take one nutrient, say like iron in apples, you need to eat three apples today to get the amount of iron you would have gotten from one apple in 1950. That's pretty shocking. We've had this kind of nutritional inflation of our food. And, you know, this was something predicted by the organic pioneers back in the 30s and 40s, that if you, you know, if you chemically feed the soil, you are not going to get the kind of complexity you get from a real living soil. And that will, of course, affect the quality of the food. So we need to feed the soils. And, you know, composting is the way to do that. I mean, if you compost and return compost to the soil, you will replenish it and you will end up with more nutritious food.
Surely. Back to our phones. Laurie is with us. Hello, Laurie.
Hey there. Hey, I was just listening to this, and it's very frustrating as a mom of three kids who are 10, 7, and 6 to listen and to hear people say, oh, it's too hard to fix food from scratch. And the processed food, I struggle with this every day. I have a mother-in-law who recently bought those cereal straws for my kids, which is probably the most processed you could get. And, you know, my kids, how much more they enjoy things like today they had homemade pumpkin muffins and they ate every last one of them that I made. Or, you know, chicken fingers that you buy the chicken and cut it into strips and dip it in your own egg batter and the cornflakes and bake them yourself. And how much tastier they eat better. They eat healthier and they eat more and they ask for it again and again because they do enjoy it better. And I just would encourage everybody to take a little bit of time and, you know, if you have the time one day, make a double batch and then freeze it so that on those nights when you're rushing around, you can still pull it out and have a healthy meal for your kids.
Excellent.
Boy, that is, you know, you really got it. I mean, I think that that's so true. And to too many people, what you're describing seems, you know, Herculean in its difficulty. And it's not. I mean, we've overcomplicated cooking and we've convinced ourselves. And I think partly because we watch these cooking shows on TV and we watch these heroic chefs doing these incredibly complicated things. But, you know, good nutritious food can be prepared fairly quickly. And, you know, it's not as if it takes no time at all to microwave either. If we took the time we spend watching cooking shows, microwaving, and actually put it into cooking food, we would be so much better off. So you're doing a great thing for your kids. And that those shortcuts to those processed foods are, you know, it's a very short-term solution with a lot of long-term problems.
Exactly.
Laurie, thanks for your call. And hi, Ruth. You're on the air.
Yes, I have an answer to your question about heavy metals in urban gardens.
Yeah.
Oh, good.
We had a pie cherry tree that we maintained in our front yard, and also a friend at Ohio State University Ag Department who took some of our cherries and did heavy metal analysis on them, and cadmium and those, not just lead. And they were many, many times higher than rural-grown cherries.
The cherries themselves, oh my goodness.
The cherries themselves. So it's not just the soil. It's what comes in through the air.
Through the air.
Through the leaves.
Well, that's, my goodness. That's very concerning.
Yeah.
Thank you for that information.
So we stopped eating those cherries, and when people would offer to pick them, we told them, this is what they've got, and they'd say, thank you, goodbye.
Well, so Ruth, this throws into question the whole idea of an urban garden then, doesn't it?
Well, we are on a fairly heavily traveled road.
Yeah.
So that being out in the front, you know, near the cars without a building between
yeah.
them, I don't know. And we have a little side yard garden now that I hope is more protected because I love it.
How do you know it's the air and not the soil?
Well, it's probably a combination of both, but, you know, plants take in nutrition from the air as mm-hmm. well. I mean, you can spray fertilizer on your plant
right.
leaves, and they will take up that nutrition. And so it comes from both, I'm sure.
Well, Ruth, sobering, but thank you for that analysis. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
And hi, Cindy, you're on the air.
Hi, just had a question about lawn treatments and live in a subdivision, and I've hesitated to put a garden in because I think of all the fertilizers and pesticides that we and our neighbors would use.
I think over time, you know, those things do leach out. So I wouldn't assume that the soil in your lawn is contaminated from those kind of things. And you can bring a soil back to life. There's a lot you can do to revive it. And so what I would do is just simply get the soil tested. It's not a big deal. Usually Agricultural Extension in your community will take care of it. But if you go to the garden center, they'll give you a bag, and you can send
okay.
it off and have it tested.
So ongoing, we live on a hill, and we're nearer the bottom. I'm worried about, drain off, ongoing from, other
sure.
lawns. Just periodically have it tested then? Is that...
Yeah, I think that that's really the answer. And, you might want to terrace your garden if you're on a hill.
Okay.
That could help also.
But also, Cindy, if your neighbors are spraying all those lawn chemicals on, you've got to also talk about it at certain times of the year, that being transmitted through the air as well. It's complex, huh?
Well, and I don't even know what people are putting down. I just know that we have some lovely lawns, and I'm assuming it's not organic.
Yeah, I would assume in many cases it's not.
Well, it doesn't hurt to ask your neighbors about it, too, and see what they're actually using.
Sure.
Okay.
I think that would be wise, and there are ways you can protect yourself from that.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks, Cindy. 614-292-8513, open line at WOSU.org. A few more minutes with Michael Pollan in defense of food, and Jim is on the line. Hi.
Hello, Michael and Fred. I certainly appreciate being able to talk to a couple of my heroes.
Thank you. That's very kind.
I put down my wheel hoe in order to come in a few minutes of break and express thanks for mentioning grandmothers in the soil. Because I've been studying what my grandmother taught me, and I've been teaching organic agriculture since the 70s.
Uh-huh.
So Grandma taught me how to do it, and I'm trying to pass it on. And I think you guys have hit a lot of the good points today.
Yeah. Do we not, Jim, quite an organic farm industry here in Ohio, more and more, and they bring their products to the local farm markets
as well. Oh, Fred, I'm glad you brought that up, because I might have forgotten to bring it up, and I hate to say this, but no.
You say no?
No.
Why do you...
Our students are too lazy, and our industry is too self-congratulatory about what they're doing. And if you actually look at the number of acres of organic agriculture in Ohio right now,
mm-hmm.
especially vegetable production, it's minuscule.
Really?
I have no idea where Eden Foods is. I don't travel like to California and around the world and see where the big names get their organic stuff. But if you're looking around for a student or someone who will actually get out and produce enough food for anything more than his own family, I'll congratulate you to find any.
Well, Jim, I know there's OFA, the Ohio Ecological Food and Farm Association.
I'm very, very well aware of all of that. Fred.
And so there's some acreage,
it's
right?
It's minuscule compared to the demand and need.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Would challenge any youngster who thought that they had enough intelligence and drive to actually do it. And by the way, I'm a worker on a 200-member CSA, and we supply a couple of the major restaurants that your reviewers mm-hmm. like to praise. So I'm not talking from a perspective of wonderment.
I understand.
Well, you know, the demand for this kind of food is outstripping the supply right now in many, many places. The potential to grow it in a place like Ohio is great. You've got wonderful soil.
Very great, yes.
And wonderful. You have an Amish farming tradition, too, that's, you know, one of the best in the country.
We
have to build on that.
Well,
and we need a generation of young people going back to the farms to grow this kind of food because they will be able to sell it.
Jimmy, you're saying?
Absolutely. That's why I wanted to make this point. It's a market, way under, and it's because
surely
our students are way too lazy, and our intelligent students think that they can make their money balancing portfolios of.
Okay.
Jim,
well, Jim, got to move on. Appreciate your call. Hi. Thank you. Dot is with us. Hello, Dot.
Hi. My question is, what is your guest's take on the Eat Right for Your Blood Type?
Remember that book that came out, Michael, a while back?
Yes.
Yeah, I have to confess, I haven't read it. I think that there are some genetic differences between different people that would argue for slightly different diets, and certain people are well adapted to certain foods and not others. For example, Asians have trouble digesting lactose and milk. But from what I understand, that represents a relatively small proportion. I mean, most of us will do well on the same diet if it's healthy. So I shouldn't comment on that particular book without having read it. But I think the genetic differences are less important than what unifies us when it comes to diet.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, thank you.
Dot, thanks very much for your call. And on to Mary here. Hello, Mary.
Hi. I just wanted to comment that literally decades ago, I think it was when we were living in Scottsdale, Arizona, anyhow, there was a family that were being poisoned, and they couldn't figure out what the problem was. And they got around to thinking that maybe it was something in the glaze of the pottery that they were bringing back from Mexico and using on their table, et cetera, et cetera. And it turned out that they lived on a corner of two very busy streets, and they had a garden.
Yep.
And they were poisoned by the vegetables they were growing in their orange garden because of what was in their soil.
And probably at that time there was lead in motor fuels as well.
Exactly.
So that would be pretty horrific. Well, you know, just in the closing couple of minutes here, Michael, just a caution. But as you point out, we've got lots of ways, just in the final minute and a half here, of getting away from this traditional Western diet, right?
Yeah. I mean, look, the first thing to do is get out of the supermarket, and eat from other sources when you can. But if you are in the supermarket, eat from the peripheries of the supermarket, the food that's been least fiddled with lines the edges, the perimeter. Fresh fruits and vegetables, milk, meats, fish. You're much better off there than shopping in the middle, which is where you get into trouble with the processed foods. The book offers a bunch of very practical rules as to how to change your diet, both in terms of the content of it and the form of it, the kinds of, eating habits you have. It really is my attempt to make things very practical and accessible to as many people as possible. It is doable. I know it is doable to get off this Western diet. It takes a little bit more time and a little bit more money, but it's an investment that will pay, rewards, not just in terms of your health, but in terms of your pleasure, too.
Mm. And you sum it up, Michael, in the illustration on the front of In Defense of Food. Is eat food, not too much, mostly plants.
Yeah, it really comes down to those seven words. The hard part is, well, what's food? And you have to learn how to distinguish it from the edible food-like substances that increasingly are taking over our food supply. But I offer some rules on how to do that. And that's why the great-grandmother rule is important. That's a way to, if you imagine your great-grandmother with you in the supermarket, and she was picking up one of those packages of, say, squeezable yogurt or those cereal tubes that woman mentioned a little while ago. Would she know what that is? If you ask yourself that question, you'll know whether it's food or not. If she would not know what it is, don't eat it.
Michael Pollan, In Defense of Food, an Eater's Manifesto. Michael, always a pleasure. Thanks for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me. Good talking to you.
News is next on Listener Supported, WOSU, WOSU HD 820 Columbus, streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.